Joshua chapter 5, please, and we'll get started there. Joshua chapter 5, thanks for being here tonight. Exciting stuff tonight. Chapter 6 about the fall of Jericho, and chapter 5 leading up to that. So we're going to try to cover both of those chapters in our time allotted this evening. Appreciate your attendance and attention. Look in Joshua 5 and verse 1. Now it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. So you think about all these peoples who are living over here and all the kings, they're just scared to death. And they should be because they are doomed. Almost all of them are going to die. God's army is coming for them and they know it and they're scared. And that reminds us of what Rahab had already told us back in chapter 2 when the spies had gone in there to Jericho and she had revealed that. We're terrified. Our hearts have melted and so we're terrified. The next few verses, verses 2 through 8, are going to talk about circumcision. As soon as they cross the river, God has them all get circumcised. They had not been circumcised yet for some reason. And I just want to point out here that that does not make military sense at all, to get within striking distance of the enemy and then incapacitate the entire army. But verse 1 tells us why the enemy did not attack them when they were incapacitated for a few days, and that's because they were scared to death. Their hearts were melted, and they are just hiding up in those cities and just afraid to do anything. And so they don't even come out and attack when they, militarily speaking, had an opportunity to do that. God would have made it okay anyway. Okay, so let's read the next few verses there, verses 2 through 8. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make yourself flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time. So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haraloth. This is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war died in the wilderness along the way after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, that is, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord had sworn that he would not let them see the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Their children, whom he raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them along the way. And when they had finished circumcising all the nation, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. Okay, so you notice there, verses 2 and 3, it says, again, they were circumcised again, or your translation might say the second time. Now, you can only be circumcised once. But what it means there is that they had been told to be circumcised previous to this and prior to this in Leviticus 12:3. And it was supposed to be an ongoing practice. But for some reason, they had not been doing this during that time in the wilderness, apparently. And so now God stops them and says, well, you're going to get circumcised now. And so the name of that place, at the end of verse 3, the New American Standard says Gibeath Haraloth. If you're reading some translations, the King James and others say the Hill of Foreskins. And so this is where they're all getting circumcised. Now, why had they not been keeping this law? We don't know. It doesn't tell us any more than this, but it goes along with that generation, doesn't it? There was a lot of things that they did not do that they were supposed to do, and so they were unfaithful, and to the extent that they did not have the courage to go into the land the first time, they were the ones being punished, and so maybe it's just part of that spiritual apathy that they also didn't have their kids, have their males circumcised, and so there you go. Also, by the way, just consider again the military side of this. Joshua's trust in God that he would circumcise his army when they're right there within striking distance of the enemy. And so that's his trust in God that God's going to protect them while the army heals up and they're not in fighting condition. Okay, let me pause there at the end of verse 8. Anything to add so far? Okay, in verse 9, it says, then the Lord said to Joshua, today I've rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. We mentioned Gilgal last week when they cross the Jordan River and they get those 12 stones and they make a memorial pile of stones there at Gilgal, and here it's mentioned again, and God says, I've rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So I can't tell you exactly what God has in mind when he uses that phrase, reproach of Egypt, but perhaps just God just meant, you know, we're kind of making a change here. It's the old generation has died off. The old unfaithful generation died in the wilderness. Now we've crossed the river. We're in the promised land. We've set up this memorial. We're trying to do things right. And it's a new, fresh start. We've been circumcised. And so the reproach of Egypt is rolled away. The word Gilgal is related to a verb meaning to roll. And so in God's mind, he's saying, this is a new beginning here. And he's expressing that with that wording, I suppose. And then in verse 10, while the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. All right, so time to observe this annual feast. They do it on the day that God had specified. Back in Exodus 12:6, it was going to be the first month, the 14th day of the month. Now, in looking at this, I'm not sure, maybe you can help me now or later, I'm not sure that they ever observed it for about the past 39 years in the wilderness. They observed it back in Egypt. This is the first time when they're still in Egypt, right before the 10th plague. It's the initial blood on the doorpost thing. And so that's the first time. And then they observe it the next year when they're camped in front of Mount Sinai, Numbers chapter 9. And then this is what we're reading right now, Joshua 5:10. And it's mentioned, Passover feast is mentioned in these in-between times, Numbers, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The Passover feast is mentioned, but it's never specified that they were observing it at that time. So I don't know if they were observing it or not, or if it was just part of the law that was being mentioned during that time. So I wouldn't be dogmatic about that, but I'm not sure that they, I guess I'd always thought they had been, but I don't guess I can prove that. Also, maybe God did not intend for them to observe it out in the wilderness. Listen to this. When you enter the land, which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall observe this rite. Exodus 12 and verse 25. So maybe the intention was after those first two times, when you get to the land, that's when you're going to observe this on an annual basis, based on Exodus 12, 25. I'm not sure about that. Again, let me just bring up the military thing. They've crossed the river. The enemy is terrified. From a military perspective, if you were a general, you would be thinking, now's the time to attack. Now's the time to advance. Let's get them, you know, while they're scared. And we're right here. But first thing is they stop and incapacitate the entire army by circumcising everybody. And then now they're going to stop and observe this religious memorial, this Passover feast. And so this is definitely God doing things his way. This is not what a general would come up with to do. So they're doing it God's way, which is the only way that they should be doing it. Okay, let me pause there at the end of verse 10. Any questions, comments on any of that so far? Wyatt?
I'm 2 through 8.
Okay.
The people that they were supposed to circumcise their children. All those people are dead, right, at this point?
Yes, let's see. I guess they could have been one of the ones that was under 20 back in the cutoff at Numbers chapter 14, and now they've got kids that they didn't circumcise. So, but a lot of them were dead, yes.
Interesting, like, I just wonder a lot about God's mercy and how, you know, here we just read about, kind of like you're saying, okay, do these things now, you know. But then I was thinking about in Exodus when it says that the Lord was going to kill Moses, but then Zipporah, his wife, circumcises their son and saves him. So I just think that's interesting how, God's in control and sometimes he chooses to be merciful and then other times he might say, no, you were supposed to do this. I just think that's interesting how God's merciful, but also we shouldn't, it's like that verse, you know, shall we keep sinning that grace may abound and may never be. Like, don't rely on that and be like, oh, I can do whatever I want because God's merciful.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's not an excuse for us to just deliberately disobey, but it is good to know God is merciful. And there's a period of grace there expressed many times through Scripture. All right, Caleb?
I'm just blanking. It's probably been explained to me before, but I'm kind of forgetting what the significance of being circumcised is and why that like they would redo that and also just not do it. I know we kind of talked about like why they've done it for the past, you know, whatever, 4 years. And I'm kind of just forgetting like why they did that in the first place.
Okay, yeah. So it started with Abraham. God told Abraham, you're going to be circumcised and all your descendants are going to be circumcised. Now, why God chose that, I don't know. And I can't remember if we have a verse that ever says a reason besides just he commanded that. And then once the law came, so the old covenant law of Moses, then it became part of the old covenant law of Moses, that all the males, when they were 8 days old, the parents were supposed to take them and have the baby boys circumcised. And that was just a part of being Jewish. It was part of their law. And so they had not been doing that, apparently. And so God just chose this as a time. Stop, we're going to do this right now before the conquest really starts on the west side of the river, at least. Angel?
How they showed the other people around about them that they were God's people.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly was a distinguishing mark of the Jews. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Keith?
Numbers 9, verses 1 through 3 shows where they did observe the Passover once they have left Egypt, and they were commanded to observe it at its appointed time in verse 3.
Okay.
Numbers 9, 1 through 3.
Let the sons of Israel observe. Okay, I saw that when
that
I searched for
there.
Passover.
Yeah, you have it posted up there. I'm sorry, okay. Sir.
All right, that's the same. Okay. Thank you. Okay, let's look at verses 11 and 12 when the manna ceases. Joshua 5, 11. On the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. The manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan that year. Okay, so this is a pivotal turning point. You know, all this time, for 40 years, they've been eating the manna. And it's been giving them sustenance all this time, this bread-like substance that they called manna. And so God has provided the manna. He's provided water all this time. On at least a couple occasions, he's provided quail for them, Exodus 16 and Numbers 11. And so this bridge of nutrition for all these people for all these years. And I got to thinking how many meals that would have been. These are round numbers, so don't quote me. But, you know, it's over a million people. Let's just use a million people, though, as a round number. A million people for 40 years, 14,600 days. And if you do three meals a day, that's in the ballpark of 50 billion meals that God provided for these. And it would have been probably more than that because it's really over a million people, I think we could know for sure. So just a lot, 50 billion, 100 billion, something like that. Lots and lots of food that God provided all of that time. And you got a whole generation of people now that think it's normal, because that's all they've ever known their whole lives, to wake up and there's bread on the ground every morning. You know, so this is going to be something to get used to of, okay, we got to go pick some pomegranates or something. Oh, here's a Bible drill verse or slide that I use with the kids. Let's go get some figs or some things, you know, to eat now. So they got to get used to all of that. So the manna ceased. So manna's been happening from Exodus 16 all the way now till what we're reading now in Joshua chapter 5, these 40 years until now they're in the land and they're eating off the fruit and the produce of the land. Pretty neat that God has done this for them. So as we've been going through these Old Testament books, I keep building on this timeline. And so we're adding three things this week. Joshua 5, 10, 11, and 12 on days 14, 15, 16, if I'm reading it right. That Passover feast, maybe the third one ever. And then the next day they ate the produce of the land, and the next day the manna ceased. Okay, and then let's close out chapter 5 in verse 13. Now it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He said, "No, rather, I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord." And Joshua fell on his own face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, "What has my Lord to say to his servant?" The captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, "Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy, and Joshua did so. Okay, so just another event that I'm sure gave courage to Joshua when you see this captain of the host of the Lord standing before you there. And by the way, all of this very reminiscent of how it all began. You know, you can't help but think about Moses in Exodus 3 at the burning bush. The angel of the Lord's talking to him and says, take your sandals off, this is holy ground. And here you got the same thing, minus the burning bush, with Joshua here. And then they came out of Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, dry ground. Now they've crossed the Jordan River, dry ground. There's something else too. They observed the Passover in Egypt. Now they're observing the Passover here in Canaan. So it kind of bookends this period of time in Israelite history. So that's Joshua chapter 5. Comments, questions? What else do you want to notice in all of that? Okay, let's go to chapter 6 then, and we'll talk about Jericho and this city that they conquer here. And what I want to do is just read through all of this. I'll put some pictures up on the screen, and we'll get the events as they happened, and then we'll make some more comments on them once the chapter is read. So look at the first 5 verses, first of all. 6:1, now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. The Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand with his king and the valiant warriors. You shall march around the city, all the men of war circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Also 7 priests shall carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall be that when they make a long blast of the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up every man straight ahead. Okay, so God's encouraging Joshua, gives him these specific instructions. Again, from a military perspective, you don't just march around expecting walls to fall down. But this is God's way, and God's showing him, this is me doing this. I'm giving you the city. See the language there in verse 2. I'm giving the city to you. You fulfill these conditions, and I'll give it to you. And so God can give something with conditions needing to be fulfilled. And that's what he's doing here with Jericho. And then pick it up in verse 6. Joshua, the son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant and let 7 priests carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. Then he said to the people, go forward and march around the city and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord. And it was so that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the Ark while they continued to blow the trumpets. Okay, so here's a picture of Tel Es Sultan. I don't know how to pronounce it, but in that area today, the word tel is just an Arabic word which means mound. And they think this is ancient Jericho there. Of course, all the modern buildings all around it you see there. But there have been a number of archaeological digs at Tel Es Sultan and pieces of fallen walls found and that sort of thing. And it's in the right location. So they think that this is ancient Jericho that's there in ruins. This is the second most excavated site in the world. Jerusalem is number 1. This is number 2. So there's been a lot of digging around there. And it's also the oldest city discovered so far anywhere in the world. So there's a picture of it. Here's another view of it from the top. So if you can just imagine, if this is truly ancient Jericho, you can imagine the Israelites, before all this stuff was built around there, march around this city once a day for 6 days, following God's instructions. There's a view from the top. And then they're going to blow the ram's horns. They're carrying the Ark of the Covenant around. So this is what's happening. Let's pick it up in verse 10. Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I tell you, shout. Then you shall shout. So he had the Ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once. Then they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Now Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord. The 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets, and the armed men went before them, And the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord while they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus, the second day, they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So they did so for 6 days. Okay, so apparently each night, you know, they're going back to the camp again. So if we can imagine, again, a circle route. I don't know if they went clockwise or counterclockwise, but you know, they went around and then they went back to wherever they're camped over here in Gilgal each night. Incidentally, I buy these pictures off of a website called BiblePlaces.com, and they have little notes at the bottom of them. And the note on this one said, it was taken by the German Air Force on June 4th, 1918. And today's June 4th, 2025. So here's a picture from 107 years ago to the day. And it's before all that stuff, modern buildings are built up around. So this is, if this is truly ancient Jericho, a lot closer to what it would have looked like back then in that barren hill country in a city kind of in the middle of that. So if you can just imagine the Israelites marching around that. And then you can see it from the side. It truly is a mound. You know, it's built up there, I guess, after centuries of dust and everything blowing around it, even with all the digging still built up there. Okay, and then in verse 15, Joshua 6:15. Then on the seventh day, they rose early at the dawning of the day and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. Only on that day, they marched around the city. Just read that. Verse 16. At the seventh time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city shall be under the ban, it and all that in it that belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things under the ban, and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted, and the priests blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people who went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. Okay, so if you can just imagine the walls falling down around this city and Israel just rushing in and just destroying everybody inside. I like this artist rendition because we got Rahab's scarlet cord coming down her window over there. But that's what they're doing. So walls fall down. There's another picture from above. Here's Bryant Wood. This is an archaeologist who's done a lot of digging over there, pointing at something. Then look in verse 22. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, "Go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her." So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. Okay, so they make good on their promise that we read about back in chapter 2, that they're going to save Rahab. Her house was on the city wall, chapter 2 and verse 15 said. And so she is positioned to have that cord out of her window and to be saved. This guy, this Bryant Wood, has suggested that Rahab's house may have been on the northern side of the city. He writes, "The German excavation of 1907-1909 found that on the north side, a short stretch of the lower city wall did not fall as everything else. A portion of that mud brick wall was still standing to a height of 8 feet. What is more, there were houses built against that wall. It is quite possible that this is where Rahab's house was located." So he wonders if there's a spot over there that wasn't Rahab's house. Now, you know, how could we know for sure? Archaeology is an inexact science. Unless they go and dig something that says Rahab was here, so you know, it'll probably be pretty hard to nail that one down for sure. But it is an interesting possibility. And it also just shows, just if nothing else, that, yeah, people were building houses into the walls back in those days, and that's, you know, that harmonizes with these biblical accounts. Okay, and then in verse 24, we're almost done. "They burned the city with fire and all that was in it, only the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord." Okay, so there are, burned layers in the rubble over there that matches what verse 24 says that they burned the city with fire. Now, granted, probably lots of old cities over there had burn layers from being destroyed at one point or another. But this certainly matches the events of Joshua chapter 6. Here's a close-up on the jars. You got dozens of storage jars there with burned grain inside of them. And then in verse 25, however, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. And she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city, Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. Okay, so there's the curse. You know, if somebody tries to rebuild this, you're going to lose your firstborn and your youngest. And that's what happened later on. 1 Kings 16:34, in his days, Hiel the Bethlehemite built Jericho. He laid his foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. So the city was rebuilt for a period of time. And, you know, in the New Testament, we read about the city of Jericho and so on. Okay, that gets us through chapter 6. Now we want to talk about some of these events in here, but let me just start by opening it up. We've got almost 15 minutes. What do you want to talk about? What do you notice from that record of events? Anything you want to point out there that is interesting to you? JR?
Tells them, you know, don't take anything really out of the city except for a few select items, and those are going to go basically to the priesthood for that function. Yet here they've come into the land, they've come across a river, and they've got all these people that they have to feed, and God's got them focused on, I'm fixing to give you a city in a miraculous way. Don't even worry about what you're going to eat. I've already stopped the manna. So I assume they had grain and stuff that they must have gotten on the eastern side beforehand. But he does have them very, very focused. It's not on food. It's not on gold and silver. It's on, look, I am God. We're going to do something no general, like you were talking about earlier, would ever tell you to do. We need food. They needed those things. But God said, I'll provide when the time is right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a standard operating procedure in a battle back in those days. You conquer someplace and you put yourself at risk and you survive the battle. And so you loot the play and you just pillage. And that was just the way it normally was. So he's telling them you're doing the opposite of that. And one of them does not. And that's what's going to be our topic next week in chapter 7 with Achan. Mark?
If the people of Canaan were already scared before Jericho fell, and you can just imagine how scared they were now when the Israelites walk up, the walls fall down, and they're devastated. But also going on what J.R. said, the Israelites didn't take part in any of that, which would, if the other Canaanites found out about that, they would think, well, now, you know, we can't even make a deal with these people because they're not here for our, you know, to plunder us. So they don't care about any of the stuff we have. So now we're really double in trouble.
Yeah. We can't, you know. They might be reinforcing their walls and everything. And they say, well, that's not going to work. We can't buy them off. What are we going to do? We're in trouble. So, yeah, they're trembling. Good point. Tori?
Number count of Israelites at this point.
I don't know. Let's see. Back in Numbers, you know, they were numbering 600,000 men. So when you had women and children.
All the people were involved in shouting, correct?
I have to go back and double check. But was it just, I don't know, but. Either way, that's a lot of shouting. That's loud, yeah. Is that what your question was? Were they all shouting, or was it just...
On the last day, all the people shout.
Okay.
And it It distinguishes between the first day, like just the men, like this, and the priests, and then that last day, all the people are shouting, so.
Okay, yeah. I'll be honest, I didn't look at that carefully enough to know off the top of my head. But can you imagine being in Jericho and that happens? First of all, they're marching around every day and you're scared to death. And then they all start shouting and the walls start crumbling. I imagine some of them might have died of heart attacks before the swords ever got there. Tim?
That same thing. I was going to say the same thing there, but there was one group of people that weren't scared to death. And the analogy between us, those that are following God, we don't have any reason to fear as the rest of the world does. You know, fearing death and eternity and all that, there's a definite correlation there between the people of Jericho and Rahab. One had God on their side, everybody else was terrified. And I could just see the people covering their ears every time the horns blew. And just, like I said, having a heart attack, just terrified to death, literally, of what's about to happen to them.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Amazing event. Yeah, right. She had faith and God rewarded her for that. Okay, good. What else? Sir?
On the fact that it was a gift, but they had conditions.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, I've got a couple slides about that. And I know you just saw these a few weeks ago when we talked about salvation, and I use this as an example of the fact that God can give something with conditions. So he tells them in verse 2, I've given Jericho into your hand, but of course, they took the city in the sense that they fulfilled the instructions or the conditions that God had set by marching around. So he gave it to them. It's a gift, but they had to march around. They had to shout. They had to do all the stuff God told them to do to receive the gift. And I just think that makes a good parallel with salvation today. Salvation is a gift of God, just like Jericho was a gift to Israel. We don't earn salvation ourselves, obviously, by good works, just like they didn't earn the land because of their righteousness, Deuteronomy 9:6. And yet there are conditions. They had to march around the city to get Jericho. We have to do the will of the Father in order to enter heaven. And so putting it all together, Jericho is a pretty good parallel to what we experienced today, and I think a good teaching point for us. And then the wording in Hebrews 11:30, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. And we point out, what does the word faith mean? It does not mean they just sat there and believed that God was going to do it. Here, since we know the story, they actually got up and marched around and did God's instructions, and their faith was at work. And so that helps us understand verses like this, for by grace you've been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God. Faith does not just mean I believe God will do it for me. It's me getting up and fulfilling God's requirements or conditions for whatever it is. So Jericho, a good example, good parallel there for us to help us think about how God can give something with conditions being set. Okay, what else? Keith?
I think 1 Samuel 15 comes to mind for me from when Samuel told Saul that God has decided to utterly go destroy Amalek for what he did to Israel. And we notice the opposite of what happened here at Jericho, where they kept some of the stuff that was told to them to kill. Because they were supposed to kill a bunch of the livestock and all this, and they didn't.
Yeah.
And so we see the antithesis of this on that end, and we see the consistency of God, which is nothing but a faith builder.
Yeah, yeah, and none of this, quote, makes sense from a human standpoint. It makes perfect sense if you're trying to just obey God. It makes no sense, you know, why would you kill perfectly good animals? We could eat those tonight, you know, and that sort of thing. Why not use the spoil? Why not let the troops who went in and fought be rewarded with the spoil, you know? He said, nope, put it in the treasury. And so a lot of things that don't make sense from a human standpoint, but it's just God said to do it, so they do it. Tim?
To that, too. I have the same thought when it says it killed the women and the children. Today, that's just unfathomable to us, but God said do it. God knows what he's asking, and yeah. So it's not in us to question why he's, whether it's right or not. It's right. Yeah. God says it.
And God, we do not have that authority to make a call like that, but God, the creator of human life, certainly does. And, of course, any innocent people like the babies would go straight to heaven in a case like that and or be in the grace of God after their death. And so God can make that call, and God did on several occasions like this. And so we leave that up to him. He knows what's right. Good point. Okay? Let me make this point also. God rewards faith wherever it's found. Again, thinking about Rahab, I think that's such a comfort to us. She's a harlot. She's in an immoral occupation. And hopefully that would be a thing of the past now. But then she shows true faith in God. We talked about her when we were in chapter 2. And so she is spared. In fact, She ends up becoming the great-great-grandmother of King David and one of the ancestors of Jesus, according to Matthew chapter 1. She's remembered later in Hebrews 11 and in James chapter 2 for the faith that she had. Look in Matthew chapter 21. You know, Rahab's a good reminder to us that here's someone who needs God in her life, especially because of her past. And God's desire is always for people to turn from their sin and turn toward Him. And here's somebody who has that faith and is exercising that. Hopefully she is turning towards Him more than in just words. But in Matthew 21 and verse 31, here's another example. Which of the two did the will of his father? And they said, the first. And Jesus said to them, truly I say to you that the tax collectors and prostitutes will get into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax collectors and prostitutes did believe him, and you, seeing this, did not even feel remorse afterward so as to believe him. So here Jesus commending the tax collectors who were often dishonest and would abuse their post, and prostitutes, again, in an immoral lifestyle, and yet Jesus can recognize when they believe and when they turn from those things, he recognizes that faith. And that just shows, that's just an example of, we think, oh, here's somebody that's on the bottom of society, but God recognizes and rewards faith wherever it is found. And no matter what I have done then, I can certainly come back to God and be rewarded for my faith as well. And that's such a comfort to us. God will breathe fresh air into us, and we all need that. So, you know, if you get to a point in your life when your faith is wavering, you have doubts, if you're having trouble, if you've gone back into sin, just remember that we serve this kind of God. No matter where your life is at, He wants you to come back to Him, and you're able to come back to Him, and it's a wonderful thing. Isaiah foretold this about Jesus, a bruised reed He will not break, and a dimly burning wick He will not extinguish. Isaiah 42 and verse 3. So Rahab's a good example. King Manasseh, another good example of a wicked man who repented and was forgiven by God. Saul of Tarsus repents and becomes the Apostle Paul. So God is willing to forgive. God's willing to help us grow and reward our faith. Okay, anything else? Angel?
Excuse me. God seems to show us some of the strongest faith in some of the most unlikely places. Yeah. You know, and you see in the New Testament where the Pharisees, out of everyone, they should have known that Christ was coming and should have been the ones that welcomed him in, and instead they were the very ones that tried to kill him.
Yeah.
But then he uses the parables like the one of the Good Samaritan to say, see, the ones that you don't think about are the ones that I use.
Yeah, yeah, so wherever that faith is, the most unlikely source, God sees and rewards. Okay, and then I guess the last most obvious example or lesson here is no stronghold can resist God. You know, when they 12 spies originally spied out the land, they said, the people who live in the land are strong and the cities are fortified and very large, Numbers 13, 28, which is true. There are big people there apparently, big walls. And of course, it didn't matter a bit when God was on their side. Just a great lesson for us. Look at our society. It's Pride Month right now. Look at the sin that's tolerated and promoted. And we look at that and we think, you know, how can we ever succeed against the strongholds that are out there? But of course, when we're on God's side, we're going to be victorious. We don't have to fear because we're doing what's right based on what God says. God calls Satan the devil, our adversary, the devil, who prowls around like a roaring lion, 1 Peter 5:8. Doesn't matter. We're lion tamers when we're on God's side. God can take care of that. And so we can have confidence. We go back and read these old stories like this. It just reminds us of the confidence that we ought to have when we place ourselves on God's side. Got about 1 minute left. Anybody got a final comment you want to throw in before we close it down? Keith?
I want to continue the thought also about killing the mothers and the children. That had to be a hard ask for a yeah. lot of the men that had to go do this. But we're asked the same thing. We're asked to pray for our enemies, to heap coals of kindness upon them. And that can be, that doesn't sound too hard until you're at the moment of that trial where Do I get mad or do I pray? And that's where God tests us. And that's where God shows that he can, his love is for everybody.
Okay. Just like the story of Jonah illustrates. Okay, thank you for your attention this evening. We'll plan to pick it up in chapter 7 next week.